Hello and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It's a good morning here. President Biden was showing some vigor last night. We have more good economic news with an expectations beating 275,000 new jobs and a big win from the Denver Nuggets last night. So I'm pleased to be here to discuss it with White House Communications Director Ben LaBolt. We're going to hash out the speech, and then after a break, we'll get Will Salatin to talk maybe about Katie Britt and her interesting performance last night, and maybe some other stuff. LaBolt, thanks for doing this, brother.
Glad to be here. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, I do have to do a disclaimer at the top. Me and Ben are friends, and not like everyone in D.C. says that they're friends if they've met at a party one time before, but Ben and I are friends. But I will say our friendship was forged through disagreement and arguing back when I was a Republican flack. So we're happy to disagree, and we can survive that. So I don't know if you have any hits on me from 2012 that you want to get out of the way before we start, Ben, but you can take one free shot if you want.
Well, I was hoping we could still argue a little bit today or find something to argue about. But yeah, I mean, we're kind of in a weird era now, right, where all of my Republican friends from back in the day who used to be competitors and we would get into arguments sort of recognize the stakes of the moment now and agree on a lot more than we disagree on, which is both reassuring and concerning at the same time.
Yeah, you picked some good Republican friends, because that's not true from some of my old friends, but we can do that off there. Okay, I got to start with a hard-hitting question, though. Sean Hannity last night suggested that the president was on something more than caffeine. The former president accused Joe Biden of being on drugs, saying the drugs were wearing off late in the speech. And then a host on The Blaze, I don't know if you're watching The Blaze, but they asked if staff had painted his hands with smelling salts. And so my question to you is, did you participate in any foul play last night? Did you put anything on the president's hands?
I think I saw another one of those crazy channels say that he'd had a Panera lemonade before the speech. I mean, look, this is what's so crazy is that MAGA Republicans and Fox and others have been spreading this misinformation that the president doesn't have it together anymore. And if you go out on the road with him, if you see him here at the White House, he's doing multiple events a week. He's taking tough questions from reporters a few times a week. And he shows a lot of this energy every single day. And it was certainly required to pass all the major pieces of legislation that he passed, to work the phones, to get the big things that he's done as president. And so they created this ecosystem out there of people who believed that the president wasn't capable of giving the speech last night that everyone here knew he was absolutely capable of, you know, that has the sort of energetic exchanges that we have with him in prep and based on different things that are going on in the news every day. And so it was almost funny to see their attempt to reset that discussion last night and say, oh, well, actually, we thought the president demonstrated too much energy last night. It was too much. It was over the top. It was really outrageous. The American people won't stand for it.
Yeah, so I want to just, at the biggest possible picture, get from you guys, like, what you felt. I had some thoughts about, you know, what the goals of the State of the Union speech could be, you know, what a State of the Union speech has been in the past, a lot of time, a laundry list, versus kind of what the president tried to execute last night. So what was the White House's view on, like, what were the goals of the night?
Well, there's always a structure to State of the Unions, but I think this one was a little bit different. I mean, part of it is it's the largest audience that the president will be in front of all year. So you do have to do some discussion about the record and certainly the economic progress that we've made since the pandemic that the average American may not have heard before, even though if you're hyper-political and watch the news every night, you had. So some of that work had to be done. Laying out a vision for a second term, you heard the president talk about a number of domestic policy items like lowering the cost of mortgages, lowering healthcare costs, but also things like restoring Roe versus Wade that had to be made clear as part of the speech. But I thought the thing that really stuck out for me that I'll remember, because I've been through a few of these, were just outlining the stakes of the moment for the country and opening the speech in a way that talked about democracy being at threat abroad and at home, and revisiting the events of January 6th, revisiting the fact that there's an active group of people out there that still believe that Joe Biden lost in 2020 when he won, and then cheered on people who tried to overturn the results of a free and fair election. The president, you know, ran in the first place because of the stakes of the moment after Charlottesville, because of the risk that was posed by Donald Trump. Those threats to democracy still very much exist today in a way that, you know, just a person going about their daily lives may not focus on. And so I thought setting the table around that was really important last night.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't have to start with Ukraine, right? I did think, I thought that was very notable that he comes out very hot starting about Ukraine. That I think the maybe, and now this might be my 80s kid, you know, Republican showing, the moment that hit me the hardest came towards the very top when he's talking about Putin. We're just going to put in the clip.
My message to President Putin, who I've known for a long time, is simple. We will not walk away. We will not bow down. I will not bow down. In a literal sense, history is watching.
We will not bow down. I will not bow down. I thought that that was an interesting combination, right? As maybe a subtext there, attack on the former president, but also just demonstrating resolve and kicking off with that. I mean, I have to imagine there's some pushback on that internally. Like, do we really want to start with Ukraine, you know, given all the potential issues? So talk about that choice and leading off with the clear contrast with Putin and maybe a subtweet of Donald Trump.
I think it comes to the fact that former President Trump has always embraced strongmen and authoritarians. And now he's saying here in the U.S. that he wants to be a dictator on day one. And the fact is, people should take him at his word and take him seriously. I think, you know, there's still too many people out there that will say, oh, he's just a performance artist. He's joking around. He doesn't mean what he says. We think he's dead serious about what he's saying. And you can look at what's happening abroad in countries where rights and freedoms are being rolled back in very significant ways. And that's what's on the table here at home. And you've already seen what's happened in terms of reproductive rights, in terms of IVF for families who need to access that option. And so I think part of it was about making very tangible and clear what that type of authoritarian attitude and belief in being a strong man is all about. And the fact that it sort of undermines the essence of what America is all about and what America's always been about, you know, whether there were Democrats or Republican presidents in the past. They've all kind of shared that belief in small d democracy until Donald Trump.
Because that's the direct tie, right? So you go from hitting Putin into January 6th. The next best line for me that I want to just put in here, let's just listen to President Biden.
My predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th. I will not do that. This is the moment to speak the truth and to bury the lies. Here's the simple truth. You can't love your country only when you win.
You can't only love the country when you win. Mike Johnson squirming behind the president there. I don't know if you guys had a Mike Johnson cam going, but again, he didn't have to do that, right? Like, you could have started the speech talking about the IRA. Right. Like, there are a lot of things that you could have started the speech talking about. And, you know, you go immediately into the Putin contrast and then start talking about January 6th. Talk about the rationale for that.
Well, look, I think that MAGA Republicans are still very focused on whitewashing the events of January 6th and saying that these were patriots at the Capitol.
Great patriots.
Exactly. And you've got
not
the former
patriots.
President,
great patriots,
you know, playing a song at his events that pays tribute to that moment. And, you know, the president talked about the fact that we need to bury lies. And, you know, enough people are seeing this at events or hearing it on channels that they trust, from elected officials that they trust, from candidates that they trust. And those lies are taking hold. And so I think the president last night really wanted to call that out, really wanted to bury the lies in real time in front of the American people, and reach out to all those Americans who, by the way, in 2022 said they weren't going to vote for election deniers, reach out to those folks who supported Nikki Haley and said they thought that the election was appropriately settled in 2020 and that President Biden was the legitimately elected president, and have concerns about this denialism that's been going on out there.
You're not a fan of the January 6th choir there, I take as a subtext. That's not in your Spotify rotation.
I find the lyrics to be a bit concerning. I'm not sure about you.
The Haley thing, I was going to ask this, but it's, you mentioned that, you brought it up. Just think about the priorities, right? There is this balance in a speech like this last night, right? Versus, you know, you could have focused it on bragging about accomplishments. To me, the first 20 minutes really is talking to the, I felt hurt, I guess is what I'm saying, as somebody that was aspiring to be a Haley voter in Louisiana that didn't get the opportunity to, I felt like you were talking to them directly and the people that look at those polls and say, hey, like there is somebody out here that believes in NATO, believes in the free world, thinks the election was legitimately handled, isn't cool with storming the Capitol. I mean, there was a lot of pearl clutching by some on the right about how political of a speech it was, but you know, at some point, like, that was the intent, right? To create a clear contrast about the, on a values level?
Absolutely. Look, I think that if you were traditionally a Republican voter or a center-right voter, there's very important room for you within the president's coalition. And you may disagree on the margins of what the appropriate tax rate should be for corporations. Maybe that's, you know, how you...
Student loan bailout. Do you want me to start listing the other places we disagree on the margins? Or should we just... I have a little less prepared if you want.
But I think this is like you and me. We've kind of come around on the big things, agreed to disagree on the margins of some aspects of domestic policy because we know the stakes of the moment for the country, and that's how he tried to open the speech last night. He also, by the way, there's a lot of things that 66% of the country agrees on in that speech. So the bipartisan border deal with, if President Biden and Oklahoma Senator Lankford can agree on that, by the way, and, you know, 70 Democrats and Republicans in the Senate can agree on something, that's something that has broad support. You know, some of the lowering costs agenda around prescription drug costs and expanding that to all Americans, the cap on prescription drug costs, for example, that's something that 85% of Americans support. People tend to support that across parties, maybe not in Congress, but across the country. So, you know, there was a lot there that was set to address concerns about people who feel like maybe prices haven't come down as much as they want yet. You know, there's a reason he started by raising the stakes of the moment for the country. If you're somebody who believes in the U.S., believes in democracy. You know, he referenced Reagan in the speech last night, right? Those were intentional choices.
The Lankford thing, well, I guess you were watching it. Were you in the room or were you watching it back at the White House? I didn't ask you.
I was back at the White House. Yep.
So you see on TV, right, the Lankford saying that's true. It was a nice little gift from James Lankford in Oklahoma. But I thought it was interesting. Like the ghost of James Lankford was an important character for me during the speech last night, because it was like, here's this guy that is a down-the-line conservative, not like one of me, I'm not a moderate former Republican, but like a conservative Republican trying to solve a problem, and just gets the rug pulled out from under him and is alone. He's sitting alone last night, as the Democratic president is laying out, okay, here's a deal that is going to help us support our allies abroad and secure the border. And all the Republicans are like, being like, well, that's not true. That's BS. And the guy that wrote it is a conservative Republican mouthing, that's true. To me, that was a big validation last night.
Yeah, it absolutely was. And look, it was a reminder that President Biden has been able to work with Leader McConnell to pass a whole number of big ticket items through this Congress on things like infrastructure, things like making sure we're building semiconductors in the U.S. instead of overseas in Asia. You know, there was the sense when the presidency started that the president wouldn't be able to work with Republicans in Congress, but there were still a handful that he could get things done with, and still a handful that do want to get things done and work with him. But what's disrupted it is the kind of MAGAization of the party led by Donald Trump, and a whole host of political incentives that are, you know, selfish politically and not good for the country. And so you saw that play out last night. There are Republicans who want to govern, want to get things done for the president, but it's been disrupted by this takeover of the party from people who, you know, only care about advancing their own personal political interests.
Can really see the changes of our roles by the way that you respectfully call him Leader McConnell. Those were not the words that I was using talking about Mitch on yesterday's podcast. I do have to push you on one thing about the speech, and then I want to go to a couple big picture things before we lose you. So Lake and Riley, maybe the one kind of gaffe in the president last night, fumbles her name because of Lincoln Riley, who had been killed by an undocumented immigrant in Georgia. I assume you didn't plan that. I guess you would know, since you were part of the speech writing prep, that Marjorie Taylor Greene was going to be in a red hat, handing him buttons and wearing a T-shirt, which was an interesting choice, and screaming at him to say her name. And then, but he does it. Like, right, he picks up the button live and addresses her parents who are in the crowd, talks about Bo. Were you white-knuckling through that, or talk to me about that exchange about Lake and Riley?
I don't think so. Look, I think that the president handles off-the-cuff moments in his events on the road all the time. It's hard to proactively plan something around Marjorie Taylor Greene because, you know, usually with her, it's just some sort of, you can expect chaos and disruption, but you're not sure what it's going to be about. I think that was an organic moment. The president spoke directly to Lake and Riley's family as somebody who's lost a child before and thinks about that every single day. And often we'll talk about that experience. And then I think he went to the broader solution that he's put forward on the table, which is we do need a plan to secure the border. There's a bipartisan plan that's on the table, and we need a lot more people screening at the border and expediting the process around that and not have people be able to come into the country who have, you know, 6 years before they sit down with an immigration judge and an asylum officer to determine whether or not they have a right to be here. I mean, we can talk more broadly about crime as well. This is a president who didn't give in to some voices on the party a few years ago when they wanted to defund the police. He's passed the American Rescue Plan, which has provided resources to cities to bring down the violent crime rate at a historic percent over the course of the past year. And a lot of that was because they're able to hire more police officers from those funds and more mental health counselors and community interventionists that have really helped, you know, bring that down. He's been focused on it. So he's got a solution here, but I think he wanted to speak directly to the parents in that moment as well.
As the White House communications director, someone who used to be a communications director, a big part of your job is fielding complaints from people. So I'm going to make you field a couple of complaints from Never Trump World. And the first one is you just did it. You bring up the police issue. And I think sometimes there's a frustration that the White House is not making a more deliberate case about the ways in which that this administration has distanced themselves from certain things on the progressive left. There's been record oil drilling, more police funding. He's not folded to the campus left on Gaza. Is there a way to be making that case more forcefully? Do you feel like there's a hesitation to make that case more forcefully because you don't want to piss off the left? Like, how do you kind of assess that?
Well, I think we make elements of it, Tim. And I think part of the reason Joe Biden is president is because he was able to build a broad coalition that included traditional Democrats, that united the Democratic Party, but still left plenty of room for independents and former Republicans or even current Republicans who weren't comfortable with Donald Trump. And so there are some things, you mentioned energy. You know, I was looking at a chart today that said under this administration, there's both been a record reduction in emissions, but also record energy independence for the U.S. and the lowest amount of energy imports that we've ever had in the history of this country. So things like that, I think we probably could be talking more about. But I also think, you know, the president is generally for, on big policy items, these matters of big national consensus that maybe just certain factions of the Republican Party don't support. And those are issues in which, you know, he helps to bring in Republicans. So that is things like the bipartisan border deal that we just talked about, funding more police officers on the street, even on things like gun violence. Universal background checks is at like 85% support, even though they may not have enough Republican votes in Congress today, but the country supports it. So we'll identify the issues to bring folks in. I think some of it will be just these issues of broad national consensus, of which, by the way, preserving our democracy is a part, and issues like preserving IVF is a part.
So I just have to ask you, though, I was on TV with this joker yesterday. I know you have a real job, so you probably aren't watching daytime cable news in the White House, but is a Haley donor, and he's like, says to me, but I can't be for Biden. I mean, the campus left, the Free Palestine, the From the River to the Sea people, they're Biden coalition people. I can't be for them. Like, that's frustrating to me because I obviously see the difference. Like, how do you navigate, right, communicating what the White House is doing to people like that with also, like, understanding legitimate concerns people have about Gaza?
Yeah, I'd ask them to look at how thoughtful the president has been in the moment and on foreign policy issues generally. I mean, I think we benefit from the fact that he was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for decades, that he literally knows every foreign leader who's served a long time around the world, that he can bring the experience in Israel of having known every prime minister since Golda Meir. And so when events like October 7th happen, he's not caught off guard. He knows exactly what to do. And he puts our national security interests first and not politics first. And if you dig down into what he's done, he's defended Israel's right to defend itself against the terrorist threat posed by Hamas and made clear that Hamas cannot remain in power. But at the same time, there are 2 million innocent civilians in Gaza that need to be protected. It's to no one's benefit if they're threatened. And there is a serious humanitarian crisis there. And so he's worked to protect those civilians, get humanitarian aid in, but still make sure that Israel is secure and has the right to defend itself. And so that's not a solution that's filled with easy political talking points. That's not really the point or what drives his leadership.
Well, it kind of is. It kind of is. I mean, you united everybody except two people with that strategy. So that's pretty good. Okay. Sarah Longwell's going to get mad at me. Two final things for you. Sarah Longwell's going to get mad at me if I don't ask you about surrogates. There's a concern out there that, look, President Biden, I think that for all of his strengths, we saw his vigor last night. You know, like, we can just be honest. This isn't speechifying is maybe not his number one skill if you're listing his skill sets. And having more people out there making the case, making, you know, the case on these issues we were just talking about, it feels sometimes, I think maybe us Never Trumpers, we're so fucking passionate. It's like the zeal of the convert. We hate Trump so much. Like, we just want people out there just channeling our rage and channeling, you know, our passion for this. And sometimes it feels like that urgency is not there. What are you going to say to that about getting more people out making the case as we get into 2024?
Look, I think the door is wide open. Obviously, I defer to the team over on the campaign on all the details of their political strategy here. I can speak to what we
have secretaries out, and, you know, I mean, we could get Mayor Pete could be doing some things besides filling potholes. You know, we could get him on the tube.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we've got an aggressive travel schedule for the president, vice president, first lady, second gentleman, and cabinet. They're going to fan out across the country over the next month and do versions and states of the State of the Union address. I think part of the challenge we face is it's just harder to reach people today. So one of the things we've done here is we've hired a director of consumer media that recognizes the fact that in 2020, the number one show for persuadable voters wasn't the news, it was The Bachelor, right? We've got to be on dayside TV that's not overly political. We've got a podcast strategy. Yeah. We had a bunch of digital influencers here at the White House last night.
Bro podcast. You got to get on the bro podcasts. You know, we got to reach them. They're not ready to be dads.
We do the bro podcast, but we also talk to folks, you know, here on the center right. But it's just because things are so fractured, we basically need to dial up volume as much as we have trusted validators, because I think we have a good group of folks, but the door is always open for more.
All right, very last thing, just kind of on a personal level, because I don't know if folks know you that well. You know, you're not like a Biden lifer, like many people around him. You didn't live in D.C. You weren't like looking for the next gig. You weren't unemployed. You were employed quite successfully in San Francisco, actually, when we had hang out in the Bay Area, and had left D.C., and so you decided to get back in, to return, to go back into the White House to work for Joe Biden. And so I'm not saying this is like some great sacrifice, but it was a choice, right? To re-engage in government, to re-engage in this, you know, democratic fight. As I recall, you didn't really know Joe Biden that well. And so I just talk to people about like that decision, going back in, meeting with him, meeting with First Lady, meeting with the team, and kind of deciding that this was something that was worth getting back engaged in.
Absolutely. Look, for me, this has been about the stakes of the moment. As you know, Tim, I spent the first 10 years of my career sort of as a political junkie, campaign junkie, working on the Hill, in the White House, on campaigns. And I thought I'd spent about 10 years doing that and then transition to a more balanced lifestyle where you're just not sitting at your desk eating, you know, pizza all day. There's
wine, kind of, yeah, a more balanced lifestyle, Napa, you know, a regular job, weekends, things like that.
Exactly. You know, like finding some moments of joy that weren't just work driven. And I spent the next 10 years doing that. And frankly, I could have spent the rest of my life doing it. But, you know, I didn't know, and many people didn't predict, that Donald Trump would become president. I didn't know and couldn't predict that he'd be running again. I did get to know, you know, then Vice President Biden just a bit, having worked on both Obama and Biden campaigns, and had a sense of what to do in a campaign communications operation, what to do in a White House communications operation. And so I figured I'd volunteer, and I helped on the transition. And then I came back and I helped confirm Justice Taji Brown Jackson. And I saw the president build up this incredible record. And I felt like the press never really understood him or gave him the appropriate credit for that. And I also know, with the fracturing of the media and sort of all these partisan outlets out there, how difficult it is to break through on your message at all anymore. And so there was this big challenge facing the operation, which was the president has an incredible record and vision. I know what he's like as a leader in the room. But there was a misperception out there nationwide of what that was. And these heightened stakes to the moment where, you know, I do want the U.S. to still feel like the country that I grew up in. And I think this is a year where everybody's going to have to ask themselves, do I have some extra time to give? Do I have a skill set that I can access here, or a network that I can lean on a little bit more than I would in a normal year? Because this is a moment that's going to take all of us, with whatever skill set we have and whatever network we have. And we can't just consume the news, but we have to participate in this moment to intervene. And so I felt strongly about that. I'm a big believer in the president. I didn't think he was getting sufficient credit. I knew he was capable of the type of speech he gave last night, and I'm really energized for...
Does he yell at you? I hear in West Wing Playbook he's a yeller. I say that he's a yeller.
I would not describe him as that at all. As you know, I like a good kind of sarcastic ribbing every once in a while. You know, I grew up in a household with a lot of that, and so every once in a while I get one of those, but it's always good-natured and something you're able to laugh off and smile about a little bit.
It's deserved. You deserve a fucking ribbing. Ben LeBolt, I'm happy you decided to go back into the White House. Let's stay in touch over the next few months. Thanks for doing the Bulwark Podcast, brother.
Great talking to you, Tim. This was fun.
All right. We are back with my colleague, Will Salatan. And I want to just be totally transparent with everybody. We're trying out this thing where I would like to have more newsmakers on here, especially on big days like the day after the State of the Union. But, you know, my friend Ben LeBolt, if you're a communications director, it doesn't always make for the best pod, right? Like, you got to be on talking points. You know, there's a lot of subtext there you got to read through. So my idea on how to handle this is that we'll interview some politicians, some spokespeople, and then bring on Will Salatan or some of our other colleagues and, you know, help you translate a little bit, help you translate what they were trying to get at, what we learned from those conversations. And so give us a comment there in the Substack, or send me an email. Let us know what you think about that. William, thank you for doing this. How are you feeling this morning?
Good, good. Tim, you know, it's really cool for you because you've been on both sides of this. You've had to be the boring guy, and yeah, now you have to interview the boring guy and you make it less boring. It's just a great challenge.
It is. I've been enjoying it. I don't know if you could tell during the interview, but I enjoyed ribbing Ben by saying things and asking things that I knew that he would have to be the straight man, you know? And so I get to be, I sort of like, it's more fun for me, frankly. So, well, Before we get to LaBolt, just at the top level, I'm curious what your thoughts were about last night, about Biden first, and then we can get into my good friend Katie Britt and what the weird little thing that she had going. So what did you think about the president?
Well, he solved his main problem, which was that the Republicans had painted this box he was in, which was he's old, he's feeble, he's Sleepy Joe. And he definitely wasn't sleepy. And of course, all the reaction from Republicans afterwards was, he's so mean and partisan. That's fine, because what he needed to do was break that cliche about himself. And he totally did that.
Wait, just really quick, what did you think about the mean and partisan thing? Because sometimes I feel like maybe I can't be a clean judge on this anymore because I hate them so much. I hate the Trumpers so much. And like Mike Johnson, I just has a punchable face for me. And I just so, you know, old Tim 5 years ago, I feel like you have much better equilibrium on this. Like old Tim 5 years ago, I think would have been more sensitive to having a speech be a little, you know, feel more politicized than it should be in that chamber. But new Tim was kind of like, hell yeah. So anyway, what, like, can you give me maybe more of a dispassionate look at that?
I can't get past. These guys are complaining. They've got people heckling. They got a lady in a MAGA hat, you know, handing a button to the president.
Did you see the guy in the T-shirt, the Never Surrender T-shirt with the
bow? Oh, yeah. Totally. And didn't like Trump in his last State of the Union, like say he was going to give Rush Limbaugh the Medal of Freedom? Yes. I mean, come on. Like, you know, the same way that Biden can't compete with Republicans on being right wing about this or that issue, he can't compete with Republicans about being mean and partisan. I'm sorry. He's just never going to be there.
I think that's right. So on the substance?
On the substance, a couple of things. First of all, I thought that Biden did a really good job of trying to reach out to the Haley vote, trying to reach out to disaffected, you know, Reagan conservatives. He starts off with Ukraine, an issue where he's with them, right? He does the border stuff. He says, look, which is another thing Nikki Haley talked about, right? We should pass the border bill. We actually should solve the problem and not just have an issue. So I think that he did a great job of that. And he also said something really interesting. There's this theme about, it sounds boring to you and me. It's a wonky thing. We're going to actually solve problems. But if you can frame an election around that, I'm the guy who's actually trying to solve the problem, like the border. And they're the people who just want the issue, right? They don't solve things. They just do press conferences. They're just, you know, peanut gallery. That can be effective. So I thought he did both of those things well.
Yeah. I changed my mind. We're going to save Katie Britt for dessert because I just want to just sort of just swim in it and just kind of spend a lot of time just sort of just really taking it all in and thinking about the performance and appreciate it. Kind of like when you sit at the end of a movie sometimes where the movie's so good, you have to kind of sit through the credits and just let it wash over you. I want to do that with Katie Britt at the end. So let's go back to LaBolt. I think the interesting thing for me, and I'm interested in what your takeaway was all of these were very intentional choices, right? Like the idea for Biden to be yelling was not an accident, right? Like the idea to start by trolling the Republicans over Putin in January 6th was not an accident, right? And so, you know, he can't come on today at the White House spokesman and be like, boom, bitch, like we trolled you. But like, to me, the subtext was very much like, yeah, it was a political speech. It was like, we felt like we had to do it. Isn't that how you read it?
What struck me was like, we've seen a lot of boring Joe Biden. When Biden has to just give a speech, there's not a lot of life
whispering.
In it.
I hate the whisper.
He does. But, you know, he does seem to do better when he has a foil, right? He's got Trump as a foil. He's got the House Republicans. He's got Mike Johnson. And so that old fight picking thing, I think they were also getting the best out of Joe Biden when they did that.
I agree. And, you know, there is some tension. I was listening this morning to Stephen Hayes was bringing up that there's a little bit of tension between like this idea that, oh, the Republicans are this grave threat, Democratic threat, that they're my foil. But also, America's doing great. Like, the State of the Union's getting better. Like, there's this tension between Joe Biden is fighting for the soul of the nation and brings people together. And Joe Biden is also, you know, tomahawk dunking on Marjorie Taylor Greene in the crowd, right? Like, there is tension between those things. And you do kind of have to choose. And in 2020... he'd slip at times. In 2020, 95% of the Biden output was very unity, norms, soul of the nation, right? And to me, I think we learned last night that 2024 is going to be a lot more, no, F these guys, they're dangerous. We need to beat them. We have to fight. And I think that that's probably the right choice. I don't know. How do you assess that?
I don't even think it was a choice. You can't be a perfect unity candidate. You can't say I'm with, you know, Donald Trump and the MAGA people when they're attacking basic American values. If you're going to stand for the unity of America, that we know what Biden called the North Star, just basic things, common sense, decency, equality, democracy, the rule of law. when you have another party that is attacking those things, you have to fight them because you're defending America. I don't think Biden was going to be able to get through an election against Donald Trump by pretending to agree on all that stuff. He's going to have to fight if he's going to fight for us.
What else did you take away from Ben?
You know, even though he was trying to just stick to the talking points, he did let on. He did say, for example, that at the top of the speech, Biden goes to Ukraine, talks about Ukraine at the beginning, which I was very surprised by. And then Biden goes to January 6th. And Ben basically said that was a choice. We wanted those two things to be paired together. And at the time, you know, Mike Johnson got a lot of crap for not standing and not applauding on the Ukraine stuff. Russia's invading Europe. Why are you, you know, conservatives not standing? But maybe Mike Johnson understood that that was the segue. And that because Mike Johnson has to stand with the autocrat at home, Donald Trump, he can't, you know, applaud the part about the autocrat abroad because that's Biden's, you know, painting them together. So I thought Ben was really clear that the threat to democracy at home, the threats to democracy abroad, we're going to bring those two things together. And that kind of puts the Republicans in a box as being friends with both Trump and Putin.
Yeah. The Mike Johnson thing I do think was disorienting, though. It was he seemed confused. I think he seemed disoriented. Eventually, he sort of found his footing as I'm just going to roll my eyes and wince and shake my head. But I think he got a little caught off guard by the beginning because there were a few times where he's kind of like half clapping and he's looking around and it's like, what should I do right now? Because it's unnatural as somebody who is not too much younger than Mike Johnson. We all grew up at the same time. We're Republicans. It's unnatural to not clap when the president's like, we're going to stop Vladimir Putin from invading our, you know, a democratic ally, right? Like that we are that America is going to be strong, that we're going to stand with our friends, right? Like some of these, like that we will not bow down to Putin. You right. want to kind of be like, okay, yeah, that's right. But you don't, you know what I mean? Like, is this a bipartisan stand up? I think he was disoriented, and it was disorienting for me as a watcher to be like, this is really where we are now, right? The Democrats have somebody in the crowd with a Ukraine right. flag, a congressman, you know, in a suit, also draped in a Ukraine flag, and the Republicans are sitting.
This is a really great point. You're making me think about Mike Johnson as a metaphor for what's happened to the Republican Party. Situations where a Republican speaker would have stood in any previous right era of the Republican Party won't do it now. You're totally right about Johnson, by the way. He seemed to have adopted an idea that he's not going to stand in general. He's not going to react in general, so he doesn't have to pick and choose. But then he did. So on the Ukraine stuff, Biden brings up Ukraine. Johnson won't stand. Biden says, just bring up the Ukraine bill. It'll pass, right? Or bring up the border bill. It'll pass. At that point, Johnson has to react. He's shaking his head like, you know, it wouldn't pass. Of course it would. And the guy sitting there not standing up, Mike Johnson, is the reason why these things aren't passing. If you put them on the floor, back to your point about consensus, you'd get 3/4 of Congress on these bills, right? But one guy who's enthralled to, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and would lose his job if he did it is holding it back. So he can't stand for that. Can we talk a little bit about Gaza for a second? Mike Johnson, there were 3 points when Biden was talking about Israel and Gaza when everybody stood up, right? One is Biden says, we're going to get the hostages back, right? Everybody stands. Kamala Harris stands.
Except for Rashida Tlaib and Cori Bush. We do have to say, Rashida Tlaib and Cori Bush both sat during that. And I will say that Cori Bush, there's an ongoing primary, and we might be trying to get her opponent on this podcast. And so I was watching that last night, making a mental note. And I was like, we need to try to track down Wesley Hunt, because this is fucking gross. But anyway, everybody but 2 people stood up for getting hostages
right.
back.
Oh, this is great, though. This is now we have an actual left-right dispute at the bulwark, because I wasn't looking. I'm with Ben LaBolt. I don't want to talk about those people. Like, okay. Don't bring them up. Okay. But let me set them aside for a minute. Mike Johnson. So bring the hostages back. Everybody stands up. Mike Johnson stands up and applauds, right? Then Biden says, Israel has a responsibility to protect Palestinian civilians, right? Kamala Harris stands up. Democrats stand up. Mike Johnson sits. Now, at this point, you could say, maybe Mike Johnson doesn't want to stand up because he doesn't want to say that's Israel's responsibility. It's Hamas's fault. Okay, I can give him that. Then Biden says, and we're going to set up this maritime, you know, we're going to set up ships bringing aid into Gaza. Kamala Harris stands up, the Democrats stand up. Mike Johnson won't stand for aid to the Palestinians. Like, that's not about blaming Israel. That's about just basic humanity. These are people starving and dying, right? Yeah. I thought that was really disturbing. And to me, that was a sign of how callous a lot of people have become about the death in Gaza.
Yeah, that's one area where we definitely agree. So I thought it was interesting from hearing from LaBolt that, you know, again, there's this tension, right, where he works for government, right? So it's like, you gotta talk to the campaign about some of these things, but he's volunteering. He's bringing up Haley voters, right? Like intentionally mentioning that we're reaching out to Haley voters, intentionally bringing up that he's on this podcast because they are trying to reach out to center right voters, intentionally bringing up increased funding for police, you know, all of that. And you saw that in the speech last night too, but I really thought that kind of just talking about it with Ben, you could just really appreciate the intentionality of how they feel like that those are folks that they need. They know it. And they were trying to talk to them last night in the speech. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's
right.
Many state of the unions, like when you're writing the speech and when you're talking to your policy people, one thing that is not generally in mind is how do we talk to one faction of the other party, right? Like they, you know, and they were, I think, very intentional about that.
Right. Well, I'll give you some credit here, or maybe this is a little backstage thing.
Yeah.
So I've watched a couple of the interviews Ben's done over the last 24 hours, not just with us. So he did that for us. He did the whole, he said to you, right, you know, we're going for the center right voter. That Reagan reference that was delivered. Yeah. He didn't say that to anybody else.
That wasn't in the CBS interview.
That's a bulwark audience play. Okay. But which is not to say it isn't real, because we know from Joe Biden's career that it is real, right? He loves to work across the aisle. But that was kind of deliberate. And I totally agree with the idea. First of all, Haley just dropped out. So this is a good moment to be reaching to those people. But the other thing, Tim, is it captures what's going on in our country. There is a giant hole in American politics right now where a sensible conservative party would be, you know, a party that would actually try to close the border instead of keeping it as a perpetual campaign issue about caravans and stuff, right? A party that would stand up for a freedom abroad against, you know, a Russian invasion of Europe. And so Biden is moving into that space. He's more there than a lot of today's Republicans are, than Mike Johnson, for example, is. And I think he's very wise to move in there. And Ben's just affirming that that's what he's doing.
Yeah, it's a little cautious, though. I will say this about it. You know what I mean? And I said, like, we want it to be more fervent. So I said, look, I don't need Joe Biden, whatever. I'm not in the Bill Kristol space where we want the Biden-Liz Cheney crossover ticket. I don't need that. I really don't. Like, he can talk about climate. He's been a fairly progressive president, frankly, in certain elements of the initiatives that they've put forth. But like, as a positioning standpoint, in the areas where he's not, I'd like to see them wave the bloody shirt a little more. You know what I mean? I'd like to see them be like, you know, these two people that weren't standing up for the hostages released? I was. Okay, you notice these Republicans on Fox, they say that I'm enthralled to Rashida Tlaib and these people that are on pro-Hamas, but they're sitting while I'm talking because we disagree on this. I want Israel to release hostage. I would like to not have to pull teeth about mentioning that we're more energy independent than ever, right? Like,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, some of that stuff, I would like a little more effort. Is that too much to ask, do you think?
You want him to triangulate. You want Bill Clinton back.
Yeah, I want a little more Bill Clinton. Can I get a little Bill Clinton just
Tim,
for 6 months?
Just, are you going to win Michigan for him if he loses the Arab American vote? I mean, who are you going to deliver to, you know?
Are we worried about that? Are you really worried? How worried are we about that, really?
I don't know. I mean, it's just shocking to me that, like, anyone who cares about Palestinians would rather, like, help Donald Trump get elected, a guy who's, like, literally advocated a ban on Muslims in this country and would absolutely throw Gaza to the wolves. But let me come back to what you want out of this. Would you be happy, Tim, if Biden went harder at the police stuff? So
yes.
Let's bring people back to yesterday. You were talking with Tom Nichols about this, right? That you caught the thing in Mike Johnson's last press conference where he says, we're going to defund the FBI and, you know, the Justice Department.
ATF,
right? Of course, that's gun enforcement. We don't want that. Right. But the Republicans, like, they're talking about defunding federal law enforcement. So Biden did say in the speech, right? He did say, we have more money for cops on. I forget exactly what his line was.
He did.
But he didn't go hard at it. Would you be happier if he went hard at that?
I want him to go hard at it. Yeah. Here's the thing about Biden. This was a frustrating thing. I remember talking to Ron Klain about this at some point in 2020, where I was like, Biden, I think, if my memory is correct, there was a police officer that died on the duty, maybe in Delaware and Philly, and Biden went and spoke to at the funeral. And he was so in his element. And it was like, I was talking to Clayton about this, and it was like, this is what this guy's done his whole life, right? Like, he has been a pro-union, pro-cop, right, politician, has spoken at a lot of police funerals.
And yeah, can I see ads with Biden hanging out with cops? What was my joke with somebody recently this week? I was like, I want him on an oil rig with a hat, with a hard hat and some like oil splatter on his face. Is that too much to ask? Maybe, I guess. Maybe it's too much to ask. You can tell that they want to do it, but it just feels a little timid. It felt a little timid from Biden, a little timid from Ben. Where they're saying it, they want to check the box to do it. You know what I mean? They want to do it. But they don't. They're a little worried that if they do it too hard, that they're going to get backlash. And maybe that's a legit worry, by the way. Maybe that's a legit worry. I don't know.
Well, maybe if Biden said, you know, used illegal as a noun a couple more times, that would do the job. You had the cringe too, right?
Yeah, I cringe. I mean, maybe it's good. So I'm not, you know, I don't say that. I don't use illegal as a noun. Like, okay, I cringed a little bit, but it also made me laugh. Again, it's like there's this whole fantasy Biden, what we were talking about with Tom Nichols, right? Where it's like on Fox News, it's the fantasy that, oh, you know, he's in with the woke left, right? And that he's the social. And it's like Joe Biden, I was like, if you handed Joe Biden a speech that had Latinx in it, he would assume that it was a typo.
Right.
He would be like, what are you talking about? You know what I mean? He does not know the right words. Like, he is not part of the identity language police. And so is that a worry maybe? If you're a conservative and you're worried about that the left's going this direction, is that a worry for 2032? Sure. Yeah, I'm fair. That's fair. But you know, where you're not going to vote for Joe Biden because of it. You know, I think that the illegal thing, I don't exactly know how to do it, but I wish there was like a stealth campaign to show him saying words like that on bro podcasts.
Yeah. And just to back up for a minute on this, for everybody to understand, Joe Biden does not have a bigoted bone in his body. And this is just an old guy talking, but just let me come back to, you know, the triangulation or reaching across and establishing yourself as agreeing with conservatives about something. I don't know if crime is the issue where you need to do that. I think the border is the more salient issue because it is a serious, serious problem. He is making a play there. And if I were Ben LaBolt and if I were Joe Biden, that's what I would be pushing. I would be grabbing this opportunity because the Republican Party is sending a very clear message that it isn't, this is a Hakeem Jeffries word, they're not serious. They're not serious about any of these policy things. They talk about like it's a national security threat at the border, but the bill comes to them and they're like, no, let's wait a year. Let's wait and see if we can get our guy elected by making the problem worse. And so Biden's very wise to step into that. They've been saying, Tim, for a couple of weeks that they were going to hit hard on this. I'm not seeing enough of it. What I want to see from this White House is going hard at that border bill. Yeah. There was some in the speech, but much more of, we agreed to all this stuff that's in the bill. That clip of James Lankford saying, you know, that's so true, good. That's right.
That's
right,
true.
You know, it's really important. Go do something with James Lankford, who was endorsed Donald Trump. But Lankford is like, as you said, he's not a center-right guy. He's a right-right guy, right? And all he did was sit there and actually work with Democrats to solve what all conservatives agreed was a problem. And he gets chucked overboard. And he's still there and he's still principled. Find a way to work with him. Find a way to do something with him.
Yeah, I thought the two most meaningful moments of the speech were not from the stage, though I did think Biden was good. It was Lankford saying that's true. And then this from C-SPAN after the speech, which was Joe Biden's exchange with Jerry Nadler. Let's listen to this. Nadler says, nobody's going to talk about cognitive impairment now. And Biden, I kind of wish sometimes I was cognitively impaired. That's funny. That's funny. And so my question, thoughts on that, but also this is over, right? I'm sorry to Bill Kristol, but it's over, right? Like the whole like Ezra Klein, you know, Joe Biden isn't up for this. He put that to bed last night, right? It's over?
Yes. And, you know, speaking of bed, like Joe Biden may be the old guy, but it's like the anti-Biden people who've been wetting themselves. I mean, they've been panicking for months about like, you know, he can't handle it and we need to put someone else in. The argument for Biden on the negative side has been, who do you got in mind? Who's going to like unify the Democratic Party all of a sudden and who's not going to have some other problem? But there's an affirmative point too, which is that he can handle it. And that a lot of people were in doubt about that. I think he's put that to rest for now. There's going to be more gaffes.
Sure.
There's absolutely going to be more gaffes. But can he do it? He showed in this speech that he can.
Yeah. And there could be. Well, it's a happy Friday. The Nuggets won. We got jobs. I'm not going to bring up the other potential problems. I'm with you. Okay. We got to do Katie Britt before we go. That was the weirdest shit I've ever seen in my life. I swear, I'm not gilding the lily. My whole body, I was getting tingles on my body when she started speaking. My husband is in the chair next to me, and he started curling up into a ball out of, like, you know, vicarious embarrassment. It was so weird. You know, I literally thought somebody, like, there was going to be somebody with a knife that comes through. Like, I thought that there maybe there's somebody off stage with a butcher knife. The whole thing was bizarre. What was, am I overstating it? Where were you on Katie Britt's performance?
No, Tim, you were not overstating it. So, like all right-thinking people, I did not actually watch the State of the Union live. I was playing basketball during this. So I'm coming back from my basketball game, and I'm playing the Katie Britt speech in the car. So I can't actually see her. And I'm in disbelief at what I'm listening to. Like, is she actually upset? I can't see her face. I get home and I watched it again, and it's like, oh my God, this is actually for real.
In the car, it had to feel like a Prairie Home Companion type thing, or like a really down market Prairie Home Companion. It's like, is this a high school play that they're doing? That was it.
Like, what was it? Sorry, Julia Yaffe had the best line about Katie Britt. She said, the acting chops were somewhere between porn and high school play. You know, I mean, I was thinking about what's something boring that you would read, like the phone book. Nobody has phone books anymore. If you went on a road trip with Katie Britt, you know, and like she just have, wouldn't it be fun to have her read the road signs, like merge right, no left turn, no left turn,
no left turn, no left turn,
unvarnished.
Why did every syllable have and then why is she in a kitchen? Why is she alone in a suburban kitchen? It looks like an unused suburban kitchen. It's very clean. I don't know what your kitchen looks like. My kitchen doesn't look like that. I have a child. My kitchen looks crazy. And so she's in a very clean kitchen with like a fruit bowl, and the lighting is low. It's like, why are you in a, you're a senator. And then there were the talking points that they put out beforehand where they're like, people should call her America's mom. It's like, why should people call her America's mom? They're just meeting her. Why not just be a senator, sit in a Senate office and give a Senate speech? That's fine. Just give a B-minus Senate speech. That would be totally fine. Why are you trying to do this?
In their defense though, if Katie Britt, if she is America's mom, then that would kind of explain why America is traumatized. I mean, if your mom spoke like this to you all the time.
Somebody said to me, it was like, I felt like my mom was telling me her and dad are getting divorced.
That was right. Right. So, look, we've seen so many bad responses to the State of the Union.
I rewatched Bobby Jindal this morning just as a level set. I went back and first thing I did when I woke up, I was like, am I overdoing this? Like, I want to rewatch. Bobby Jindal's speech seemed downright normal. Like just even middle of the road, a little weird, a little Muppety, like not great, not a great oratory, but compared to Katie Britt,
right?
I think it was worse than Marco and Jindal by like one standard deviation worse.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. Katie Britt redefined bad State of the Union response. So there's been lots of bad ones. They've been boring. They've been, you know, wooden. But Katie Britt, I think what happened here is classic overreaction. For people, this is like for old people who like remember Al Gore. Like he debated one way and people didn't like it, so he went completely the other way. This was an overreaction to previous bad State of the Union. So she decides to ham it up, right? And now next year, everyone will be like, whatever you do, don't do a Katie Britt.
Don't do that. Just be normal. I think that it ends the VP stakes for her, though. Do you not think so? I mean, Trump is...
I don't
Trump
think they ever started.
Trump has a lizard brain. You don't think it ever started. Trump has a lizard brain for this. And I just think that he looks at that and it's like that wouldn't have even made the cut for The Apprentice.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like if somebody tried to do a performance like that on The Apprentice, it would have hit the cutting room floor. He wouldn't have put it on TV. So I just think that if he knows anything, it's TV. And that was bad.
And just to be fair to Katie Britt, she's young. Everybody can give a bad speech. You know, famously, Bill Clinton gave a terrible speech and had to recover from it. You know, what was it? Introducing Dukakis. I can't remember.
His State of the Union response wasn't that good either. If people really want to go deep in the archives, he gave a really kind of weird one where it was sort of like, what was it? Like on The Simpsons where you're doing the infomercial. He's like in a room with people and he was like walking. His one was also pretty weird. I recommend people go back and find that. But I don't think it was as weird as Katie Britt's. I don't think it's possible to be.
No. And you do wonder who is in the room with her when she's rehearsing this. Is there no one who says, Can we dial this down a little bit? Maybe that's a little bit too much. Apparently, no such person was there.
Yeah, I noticed that Mike Shields, former colleague of mine, was retweeting like the 5 compliments that she got last night. So I assume he was the consultant on that one. boy, I don't know. Rough trade. Okay, Will Salatin, anything I forgot? It's Friday. It's people's weekends. Do you have any ponies for people for the holiday? Holiday? It's not a holiday. In New Orleans, every weekend's a holiday, so it feels like a holiday.
Start drinking right now if you're in New Orleans. No, I don't have to do a pony, because the pony was this speech. This was a good speech. You know, cheer up, everybody. Stop wetting the bed.
It was a good speech. Things are happy. People are happy at the Blog Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back next week. Thank you, Will Salatin. We've got a great lineup of guests. We'll see y'all then. Have a great weekend.
Hello, strange woman. You sure mind me of Miss Madeline. Hello, strange woman. You sure mind me of Miss Madeline. You know your lips all painted. You know your hair, girl, is off straight. Hello, strange woman. You know I wonder what might be your name. I wonder what might be your name. You know I love you, little girl. It's so hard for me to explain.
The Borg Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper, with audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.